This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. A Bloomington Normal endurance athlete recently tried the longest and most difficult bike race in the world. Thursday Gervais quit after only a few stages in the race across Russia, but will stay on the bike.
I want to show people that they can fight and they can succeed.
Hear how she thinks the Red Bull Trans-Siberian Extreme must change to continue and have credibility. Hear how new imaging can lead to an earlier Alzheimer's diagnosis. GLT correspondent Colleen Reynolds reports on the study underway at Fort Jesse Imaging. And a blues band is reuniting. The Blue Aces performed across central Illinois from 1998 to 2003. Hear from two of the band members about the band's beginnings and why they're getting back together. All of that and a GLT News update on the way. It's August 24th, 2017. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. A new study at Fort Jesse Imaging in Normal will use a mobile PET scanner to look for microscopic signs of the proteins in the brain that are a strong indicator of Alzheimer's disease. GLT correspondent Colleen Reynolds was on hand for a McLean County Chamber of Commerce ribbon cutting and talked with doctors Ajay Malpani and Navid Youssef, who are excited by the prospects for more early detection of Alzheimer's using much better imaging equipment.
Scanning times for this machine are much faster compared to the older machines. Also, the amount of radioactive dose is reduced as compared to the older technology. Just a little bit about PET imaging. The main avenues where PET is used is really in oncology patients, where it is used all the time for diagnosis and for classification and for staging of different tumors. So, of course, the other imaging we do is related to brain and dementia imaging, which Dr. Youssef will talk more about.
When this machine isn't in use here, where does it go? And how does the mobileness of this large machine make it accessible and affordable?
I think that's a very good question, because obviously a machine like this requires a large amount of resources and money. And small communities like ours would find it difficult if we had to have this all the time. So, in effect, this is shared technology which goes to several communities in the state. For example, once a week on Tuesdays it comes to Bloomington, but tomorrow it'll go down to Alton, Illinois. And likewise, 6 to 7 days a week, it moves from place to place, offering this advanced capability to these communities. Fort Jesse Imaging has a mobile dock where the machine comes and docks inside that area, where the patients are not even aware that they are being imaged in a mobile facility, because it just feels like it's part of the building.
And this sort of mobile technology, or the ability to move this large machine, is this the future of medicine and bringing it to multiple communities and to spread the cost among many facilities? I mean, how much did this cost, and what is the investment here locally?
This machine costs between $2 to $3 million. And so the vendor who provides the service, they take it into different communities on different days. And so we will schedule our patients for Tuesdays. This machine is owned by Alliance. And so they have purchased the unit and they take contracts with different facilities.
Dr. Youssef, talk a little bit about a new study that will be launched here using this PET scanner and the implications it could have for local or regional patients.
The new study is called IDEAS study, and basically this is a diagnostic study for Alzheimer's dementia. It is estimated that there are about 5 million patients suffering from Alzheimer's dementia currently in the United States. And this number is going to grow exponentially over the next few decades. And by the year 2050, it is estimated that there will be 16 million patients. So it's a very important disease because of our aging population. The incidence is increasing, and it's a progressive disease. So it's a cause of major morbidity and mortality. It's the sixth leading cause of death. So early detection of Alzheimer's dementia is very important. A common myth about Alzheimer's dementia is that it's a disease of older population, elderly. It is true that most of the times patients are diagnosed after 65 years of age, but is now more and more diagnosed in patients in 30s, 40s, and 50s, which is, of course, very young. And these are the patients who are actually in the workforce. And more often than not, they will start suffering from a little bit of memory loss, little bit of decreasing cognition, little confusion, and people would attribute it to stress or depression. So often the diagnosis is delayed in younger patients. The reason you want to diagnose Alzheimer's dementia early is that you can intervene early. And you can not only treat the symptoms and improve the quality of life of the individual, you can also, in a lot of cases, slow the progression of disease. And it's important for the patient and the family, you know, to make important decisions in life about finances, legal issues, and stuff. So it's good to know when the disease starts and not misdiagnosed as something else. So the study we are doing is detecting a protein in the brain called beta amyloid using the PET scan. What happens in amyloid disease is there are certain proteins that start accumulating in the brain in excessive amounts. And two of the important proteins are beta amyloid, which starts accumulating in between the cells or neurons of the brain, and another protein called tau protein, it starts accumulating within the cell. So the net effect of this abnormal accumulation is that the functioning of the neurons is affected. The main function of neurons is to communicate between one cell and the other, and all our mental functions, physical activities are all dependent on this accurate communication. Once these proteins start accumulating, the functioning of the neurons is affected, and they start dying, literally. So what happens is that the brain starts shrinking, and certain parts of the brain are affected more than others. For example, hippocampus, which is the site for short-term memory, is affected earlier. So the earliest symptoms are often patients forgetting small things, where did I put my keys, and stuff like that. And then, of course, the disease progresses, patients become incapacitated, they are unable to take care of themselves, and big burden for the family, for the society, because it involves extensive costs. It is estimated that in 2017, $259 billion were spent on the care of Alzheimer's dementia only in the U.S. So early diagnosis is important, and the test that we have started first time here in Central Illinois at Fort Jesse Imaging Center is a type of PET scan using a radio tracer called NeuroSeq, which actually picks up amyloid protein in the brain. Again, it's important because you're picking amyloid in a living human being. Before all these tests, only a few decades ago, the only way to diagnose Alzheimer's dementia was to look at postmortem brain, slice the brain and stain the brain for amyloid. Here we are actually looking at living individual for this protein. So it's a very important development for the disease itself and for this community.
And so is this something you could see patients who or family members who might have a suspicion asking for this test? This is a direct path.
Yes, absolutely. Some forms of Alzheimer's dementia are actually genetic or familial, and patients who have a family member affected, you know, they're always concerned, you know, am I going to develop this disease? For those high-risk patients, it is absolutely a very important screening test. I would like to say, however, that whenever there is a suspicion or somebody needs to be screened, the patient needs to see their doctor or neurologist, because part of the whole diagnostic paradigm is starting with clinical history and physical examination and mental status examination, and then come to imaging.
Where do you see this headed? Imaging to help with earlier diagnosis and treatment. Is this just sort of the tip of the iceberg?
That's a good question. Actually, if you look at the history of Alzheimer's dementia, I would say about 80% of the progress has been made in the last 20 years. However, we still have a lot to learn. There are other tests being developed. This eye test, recently it was in the news, and this was a small study done at Cedars-Sinai Medical Center. They started looking at the retina, because if you look at retina of the eye, it's actually a continuation of the brain cells. So they have shown that amyloid also gets deposited in the retina. However, this is a very preliminary study. Only a dozen or so patients were studied, and it needs much larger studies and validation.
How close are we to more effective treatments or therapies for Alzheimer's?
There is a lot of progress in this, and I think there are several animal studies going on right now. There is a lot of interest in stem cell, but at present, as far as FDA-approved medications are concerned, we are basically aiming at these medications predominantly improve the clinical symptoms. They're really not targeting the disease. They're not removing amyloid, for example, from the brain. So I think we still have a long way to go. There is a lot of interesting research going on. So once we figure out the pathogenesis of the disease, then, of course, you know, there will be targets for therapy.
Did you have anything else to add, Doc?
We talked a lot about the diagnosis. Obviously, the silver bullet is the treatment. And that's where the diagnosis, in some respects, is getting held back, because what do you do if you know about it? But I'm sure if tomorrow we have promising treatments, we'll have a lot more patients who will probably come forward, because now something can be done about it. So then it becomes even more imperative to have an earlier diagnosis.
We've been talking with Drs. Ajay Malpani, Medical Director for Pet Services, and Naveed Youssef, Medical Director for Fort Jesse Imaging. Thanks so much for joining us today on Sound Ideas. I'm Colleen Reynolds.
And I'm Mike McCurdy. It's Sound Ideas on GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.
Support for GLT comes from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd, helping investors plan for the future and stay on track for retirement and college savings based on their unique situations and goals. Details at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. A race across Russia earlier this month ended early for a Bloomington Normal endurance athlete. Thursday, Gervais trained for months, worked closely with a personal coach, sought and received key sponsorships, and biked more than 500 miles a week. In the end, however, the deck may have been stacked against women riders, and she thinks she was misled about the road and traffic conditions. It's no secret the Red Bull Trans-Siberian Extreme is the longest and most difficult bike race in the world, 5,700 miles over 24 days from Moscow to Vladivostok. In this interview, which was delayed because Gervais was still processing the race and the end result, she says pulling out early was emotional.
I was disappointed that I didn't finish the race. I was disappointed and frustrated with things that had happened in the race. And before I talked about it, I just kind of wanted to make everything factual and not have emotions cross into my facts. It's usually not a good thing to do. And out of respect for the other riders that were still on the road, I just didn't want to throw any negative spin while they were still racing.
There seemed to be a number of circumstances that led you to saying enough is enough. Can you talk about the reasons you pulled out, and maybe start with the most important reason why you dropped out of this race?
The most important reason was the roads. In our prior interview, I remember you had asked me, you know, what about the road conditions? Well, I was led to believe that, what we saw in the videos, that was just minor. The whole roads weren't that way. In fact, they were horrendously worse. And it just got on my nerves after having head-on traffic come straight at me three different times. It was dangerous.
Yeah, in fact, we talked about
whether those road bikes would be durable enough and the tire size would be durable enough for what looked like gravel roads in some cases.
It was beyond gravel roads. If you kind of know what the rocks in a train track look like, those kind of big, sharp, chunky kind of rocks, those are the rocks we were actually going on. So, yeah, there was concerns for me with my tires as well.
So road conditions. And did you have any mechanical breakdowns then?
Because I did not.
Okay.
Yeah. No, thank God I didn't. I think there was actually, through the whole race, as far as I know, I think there were only one or two mechanical breakdowns.
So not only road conditions, but also traffic.
Yeah.
What was the traffic like?
Horrendous. You know, we were following the Trans-Siberian Railway, but on top of that, we were also following where they were laying new pipeline in. So there was construction the whole entire way. Some of it was, you know, nice new pavement, but yet it was down to one lane. And then the shoulders were all broken up. So you had angry drivers driving up the left and the right side of the shoulder when it's technically one lane and we're waiting in traffic, which is not good.
Did you have any close calls?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I did. Again, like with the three head on, and I'm reminded the roads are not reversed out there. So when I say head on the right-hand shoulder, I mean, imagine
so
that.
So they're driving on the wrong side of the road on the shoulder at you.
Yes. Yep. And then we had multiple times where drivers would pass my van, my support van, and not see that I was right there in front of the support van. And just nearly knocking us off the road.
Cutting in too quickly to get back in before oncoming traffic comes at them.
Exactly. You know, I had people slow down, swear, yell at me.
Well, at least it was in Russian. You couldn't understand.
Yeah, some hand gestures are universal.
All right. So how much of this was a surprise? Because I've seen the videos, right? You see these Red Bull videos, and you see the traffic and the semis. Was it just worse than you thought it was going to be? Did you think those were the exceptions in the videos?
I thought they were the exceptions. In fact, that's what I was told. I was told, you know, Red Bull just makes it seem very extreme, so they pick the worst parts of the roads out for their videos. It was all that way.
So you told the New York Times that this was a mental game and maybe 90% mental. How many stages did you complete? And can you talk about the physical fortitude as well as the mental fortitude you needed to get as far as you did?
I pulled out on the third stage. It was all mental. I was experiencing a lot of issues going into this. It's when the race started, you know, I really relied on getting messages from people on over social media, and my phone got hacked into. So my Facebook was shut down. My Twitter was shut down. I couldn't get any messages from support from a lot of people. That was unnerving because during the stressful times, I really would have liked to have heard those messages.
So you became isolated.
I really did, yeah.
So three stages. The first stage was approximately 400 miles. The last stage you dropped after 215 miles. Still great accomplishments. How did you feel physically after these first three stages? Do you think you could have gone on had the road conditions been different or traffic conditions been better?
I think I could have gone on. You know, I did experience some little back spasms, and we did have a chiropractor out there, a massage therapist that was able to work some of that out and my muscles in the back. I think that was mostly in part due to, you know, you ship your bike there and you have to put it all together, and if the spec is off, I think that may have had something to do with it.
And also, because you don't have the advantage of drafting other cyclists, you're sort of out there by yourself. The men were further ahead.
Yeah.
So when you were wrapping up at the end of the day, you had less time to spend with that massage therapist. You had less time to recover before the next day's stage.
Yeah, that was a problem, too. Not just at the end of the day, but our food cutoffs. You know, there was a food truck that we had to make it to by a certain time. Well, if we weren't there, we weren't getting our food.
Is that why your nutrition was off and you relied more on gels and liquids during the day?
Yeah.
You didn't get the food you needed?
Essentially, I didn't eat for 3 days anything solid. Yeah.
How does that work if you're biking 400 miles a day?
It really doesn't. You know, I'm trying to consume 18,000 calories on gels, powders, three-day-old bananas and pears that we still have left in the van.
So is this a race or is it a promotional media event for Red Bull?
You know, I'm going to be honest. I felt it was an absolute media stunt. There's a couple other riders now that the race is over that kind of feel the same way.
In fact, another one who dropped out with just three stages to go, right?
Yeah, yeah. And I respect his choice. He's a fantastic rider, and I know he wouldn't have pulled out if he didn't stand behind the values he was speaking about.
So at what point did you realize that you probably were not going to finish?
Honestly, I could tell you, right as soon as I started in the first day and I saw this pack of men, as fast as they went off, I thought, there's no way. I knew this probably going into it, that it was going to be extremely difficult to finish 7 hours behind them. But when I saw the absolute wicked fast pace, and I think it surprised everybody, the organizers as well, how fast they were going, I just knew. And I had tried to discuss this quite a bit with the organizer, saying, hey, you know, you've got to do something, because neither of us women are going to finish, given our time frame. And then, again, coming back to the hotel, trying to eat, trying to get our massage, trying to get our electronics charged back up. I mean, we were left with no time.
Yeah, in fact, you have to, there's a deadline for you to get in in order to start the next day, correct?
Correct, yeah.
What was the deadline? What was the time frame?
7 hours. Somewhere in the middle of my ride, though, I didn't get this message that they were giving us, the women, 4 extra hours. I was never told that, though, so I was still riding under the thinking that I had 7 hours.
So what was it like to come to that realization after the months of training and thousands of miles you put in that first stage to go, I'm not going to be able to do this. It's not going to happen.
It was disappointing. Again, like I said, I still wanted to do it, though. You know, I said I was going to do it. I owed it to my sponsors to do it as well. I owed it to everybody that was supporting me to stay in as long as I could. I tried to have fun with it, but again, given so many circumstances, it just kind of sucked the life out of it.
What could you or would you have done differently before or during this race? Or is there anything that you could have done that you think would have sort of gotten you maybe even to the next, to the fourth stage maybe?
You know, I still had two chances for DNFs where I could have continued on. And I could have taken those and still continued.
DNFs or did not finish.
Yeah, I still could have taken those to continue on. What I would do differently, there's quite a few things. Number one that's important is to have a support team that's experienced when you do these races. I don't think anyone going into these are, if you haven't done them, the stress and the things that need to get done to be fully prepared for this are above and beyond what you write on paper. You can have a book saying, I need this, 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 and this, but there's so many other circumstances that come up. I would definitely make sure I had an experienced support team.
Did you have a falling out with your team?
I did.
And do you want to talk about that?
It's difficult. Yeah, I mean, I will to a certain extent. You know, I don't want to start any personal or anything. I'd probably just leave it at she was not well prepared. This was not a vacation. This is a race. We don't stop because you have to go to the bathroom. I'm in a race. It's the clock's ticking.
And there was a foundation associated with your race team. What's happened with that? It was supposed to benefit kidney care.
National Kidney Foundation, yeah. And, you know, that's one of the bonuses that are great that did come out of this. We raised money for that. She's continuing on to raise money. I'm going to start, you know, I still have my See Thursday Ride Foundation. My next foundation that we're going to raise money for is the Live Strong Foundation. So, you know, I'm going to keep riding my bike and raising money to causes.
So what do you think the future holds for this race? Do you think it has a future as a race after this, after the criticism?
No. I mean, flat out no. They might for the male racers. There's so many things that they need to change rule-wise. You know, the rules about drafting had changed consistently throughout the race, not just drafting off a pack, but drafting off the vans.
They were drafting off the vans. That sounds like cheating.
Well, in any regulated race, yeah, it would be. But Red Bull Media had the choice to do whatever they wanted, and you agreed to that. So if Red Bull Media is in front of you for an hour, or the lead rider filming you, that lead rider is getting a draft.
Sure.
Technically, we're not supposed to be doing that. And for women, no, until they change the rules. I just can't see any women doing it.
Could there just be a women's only race?
You know, that was brought up. The organizers said that to run two races at the same time would be impossible, pretty much like they say about the Tour de France, really, you know. But considering that there were only 10 people in the race, I don't see where that would be a problem. Maybe if they had opened it up to everybody in the world that wants to join the race, I could maybe see that being a problem. There's only 10 people, though.
Could you have teamed up with the other woman that was racing to try to ride together to make this a little easier for the both of you? Was that a conversation ever considered, or did you have it?
That was a conversation that was brought up, but I think both of us, with our competitive natures, just said, no, we're going to do it solo alone. I knew it was not a smart idea to try and do it alone. You know, you look at how the men race. They raced in a pack, and then they sprinted off in the end. So. Sure.
So what's next for you? Race across America?
Well, possibly. I'm going to do Ram Ohio, which is a qualifier for Race Across America. And there's talk of possibly teaming up with a couple people have asked me to do Race Across Europe, which would be nice, too. But, yeah, I still have Ram in my sights.
Congratulations on what you actually were able to accomplish.
Thank you.
Yeah, and thanks for your time on Sound Ideas. We appreciate it.
Thanks, Mike. I appreciate it.
Endurance athlete and bicyclist Thursday Gervais. She says she appreciates all of the messages from well-wishers, and she apologized for not being able to respond to everyone. It's Sound Ideas on GLT. Coming up here about a reunion of the Blue Aces at a Sunday benefit at the Castle Theater. John Norton has the interview coming up. It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. A troubling problem among animal rescue groups is challenging them to overcome a particular prejudice that can have deadly consequences for animals up for adoption. Laura Kennedy has more in this edition of GLT's Animal House.
For animals at the shelter, the stakes are high regarding finding a home. And for certain animals, the odds are even more stacked against them, simply because they're black. The problem is so pervasive, it even has a name, black dog syndrome. Valerie Wellen from Wishbone Canine Rescue in Bloomington says the syndrome is a very potent problem for rescue groups. Black dogs and cats are often passed over for adoption in favor of lighter colored animals.
They're also more likely, because they're in a shelter longer, they're more likely to be euthanized than light colored dogs.
This is actually something that happens so often that shelters have an acronym for it. You know, it's BDS, Black Dog Syndrome.
That's correct.
So this really is a thing. This is not an urban legend. This is something that is a concern in shelters today.
It's a real thing, and some people call it Big Black Dog Syndrome, so BBDS. And I would say that that is more the true to be the case.
So a black dog might be more apt to be adopted if it were small?
Yes, or a puppy.
Oh.
It's the adult large breed dogs that seem to sit in shelters much longer and are more likely to be euthanized than their lighter counterparts.
Why is this happening? Why aren't people getting interested in the black, larger black dogs and black cats, too? Is it this, a feeling of black is unlucky?
I think there are a lot of cultural factors that are making this happen. When you think about folklore, when you think about old wives' tales, when you think about, even when you think about metaphors in our lives, we talk about white being pure, brides wear white, angels are dressed in white, devils maybe black and maybe red, which is also in black. So I think there's something in our culture that's telling us that black is not always good. But I think there are other factors that come into play as well. I think in black dogs, you can't always see their emotions. You can't always read their faces. And also the lighting in shelters is poor.
So if you've got a dog, a big black dog, who's maybe sitting at the back of his cage, you can't see much at all. I mean, he's just this black blur back there.
He's a black blur back there, and he's also often sitting on a dark blanket. So he's in a poor lighting. Maybe the background color is dark on the walls. Maybe his bedding is dark. He's not distinguishable for people who are visiting. There's also a problem where there's so many black dogs in shelters. It's a good policy to alternate black dogs with lighter colored dogs.
Rather than grouping them all in one area?
And so you don't walk from kennel to kennel seeing only black, because you don't see them as individuals in that case.
Do people view black dogs as being sort of generic, that they're not unique enough, like it wouldn't have a ring around the eye or something like that?
Exactly. That's true. It's just another big black dog that I can't distinguish from the other guy sitting in the cage right next door. So really, smart shelters, they'll put kerchiefs around the dog's neck.
Because any dog wearing a handkerchief is adorable. Let's just say that.
Yeah, and it brightens their face. It makes them stand out as something other than just a black blur and as an individual that needs to be looked at. Black dogs, it's hard to read their emotions. It's hard to read their facial features, especially if they don't have a colored eyebrow. Mm-hmm. The colored eyebrow really helps to animate the face.
You can get these quizzical looks, and you can get these little frowns and stuff, or the surprised look, and that's part of what makes a dog so endearing is their eyebrows.
I think if you can get up close and personal with a black dog, you're going to see that as a dog as an individual. You're going to see his personality. It's going to shine. But if you don't even get that far to see the black dog and to spend some time with it, he's going to languish in a shelter.
I spent some time on the internet looking at various shelters, and of course, they all put photos of their pets up online.
Yes.
And it seems like it's more difficult to photograph well a black pet.
It's much more difficult.
And you want to get a cute photograph, because that's kind of the hook to get somebody to come into the shelter to say, hey, I saw little Kiki online, and that was a great photo. I want to take a look at this dog.
That's true. I think if you're going to just take a quick snap, you're not going to do well with black dogs. A facial shot is very, very helpful. But you have to take your time, and you have to take a good many shots before you get
You got to worry about the lighting and the background and all that.
Yes, yes.
Is it possible that it could be at all racial, or is this going too far?
You know, years ago when I first heard about the black dog syndrome, I was convinced it was racial, and it may well be. Here's the problem. Not a lot of scholarly studies that have been done on this issue. There have been a few, and some of them point in opposite directions, that it really does exist. Others say that it doesn't exist. I would love to see a really scholarly, careful research study on the sources of bias in prospective adopters and the experience of shelter managers and what they think is really happening.
Best Friends Animal Society actually has a campaign that's devoted to finding homes for black dogs and cats. Have you thought at Wishbone of doing something special just for the black animals?
I think we have in the past, and it's something that maybe we should consider again. We do have a couple of big black dogs. I think we should do another black dog promotion to maybe have them be for adopter's choice or something like that.
So basically the bottom line is, personality is not based on the color of the coat.
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. But you wouldn't know it, because people would forego a wonderful black dog, one who has no behavioral and no health issues, for another one that's light-colored and does have some, let's say, we'll put it, quirks.
Okay.
One interesting thing is that Pet Finder,
the website
that helps people find their pets for adoption, they consider black dogs, senior dogs, and special needs all to be in the category of less adoptable. They claim that black dogs spend 4 times as much time on their application as lighter colored dogs.
Valerie, do you think this can be turned around?
Absolutely, absolutely. And there's a lot that shelter managers can do to ameliorate the problem or to compensate for the bias. One is, as we talked about, to take a great photograph of the black dogs. Some people say that black dogs do better in videos. So Pet Finder allows us to post videos now on their site. So to add videos as well as photos could help the situation. Then also improve the shelter lighting.
So when people are walking through, they're spotlighted.
Yes, yes. Here's another thing. Design really fun descriptions of the black dogs. I mean, really do a good sell on them. A couple good reasons to adopt a black dog. They are always ready for a formal event. Their coat will go with any collar, any coat, any overcoat, and your clothes won't ever clash with the dog. But mostly, they really need you. So that's the reason to adopt them.
That's Valerie Wellen from Wishbone Canine Rescue in Bloomington. The organization is holding an adoption event at the Prairie Aviation Museum in Bloomington coming up this Saturday at 10 a.m. I'm Laura Kennedy.
If you have a question for the Animal House team of experts, send that in at WGLT.org. It's Black Dog, Led Zeppelin on Sound Ideas.
Support for GLT comes from AARP, whose nonpartisan mission is to address issues of individuals over 50 and their families. Enough is Enough is AARP's effort to educate Illinoisans about the challenges of restoring Illinois' fiscal health. More at states.aarp.org. This is 89.1 GLT.
You're listening to Little Walter's classic instrumental, Juke, performed live by the Blue Aces at the former Creole Cafe in Bloomington. Sound Ideas, I'm Mike McCurdy. The Blue Aces reunite for a benefit show Sunday night at the Castle Theater. The band includes Steve the Heart Melberg, George Boyle, Billy Gault, and Al Chapman. They've been playing the Twin Cities and Central Illinois, well, from 1998 to 2003. Boyle and Melberg joined John Norton in the GLT studio recently to talk about their reunion and their humble beginnings.
It all started, I think, many years ago when I was playing with Mark Boone in Hip Pocket. And I was wanting to start my own band, and Mark Boone came up to me and said, hey, there's a pretty good drummer in town who's looking for a band. His name's George Boyle. Here's his number. So I called it, and George and I immediately struck up a friendship. We got together, jammed, and we've been playing off and on ever since then. And then we needed a blues guitar player. George knew Billy.
Billy Gault.
Right. And Billy knew Al Chapman. And so the four of us got together, did a jam, and it was butter. It was beautiful.
That's Steve the Heart Melberg. George, do you remember the phone call from Steve?
Well, yeah, I remember. Actually, I had just moved to Bloomington in December of 90, and I put on the radio on a Friday night, and I heard someone saying, "Well, I'm Delta Frank," but it wasn't Delta Frank. It was Boone imitating Frank. And when I called, him up, I told him I'd just moved to town and I'd played with Big Walter Horton and on Maxwell Street and done various things with blues players. And so he suggested Steve. And I don't remember exactly the first phone call, but I remember the first rehearsal with Steve. And it's always been real easy and maybe more importantly, fun to play together.
Yes.
Well, what made you guys so special, in your opinion?
Well, first, the love of the blues, and close to the same age. The fact that he played with Big Walter was always wonderful to me because Watermelon Slim said, "Man, you sound just like Big Walter." So Big Walter was a big influence of me. As a matter of fact, my harmonica belt came from Big Walter. When I saw him in Ann Arbor Blues Festival, he had one on, and that's when I decided I'm going to get me one.
Was that late 1960s? Or was that
would have been in 72.
Okay.
I played with him in 80, a couple years before I met Bill Gault. It was pretty fun playing with Big Walter, and it taught me a lot.
So he already knew some stuff about how to play with a harmonica player.
Okay.
And to me, that was a big factor. What we needed to do to make the song wonderful, which is a lot of listening to each other when you play. When you play, it's not so much what I'm playing, it's what I'm hearing from my fellow musicians. And so that allows me to even open up more so that I'm playing to make him sound good and to be at the right spot and not walk on him, so to speak.
To GLT Sound Ideas. I'm John Norton. The song you're hearing is Little Walter's classic song called Juke. It's done by the Blue Aces. This is the year for reunions here in the Twin Cities. But you mentioned Hip Pocket already. They had a reunion at the Castle. The Something Brothers did. The Mechanics did. Mojo Stew.
Yes.
And now the Blue Aces.
Yes.
What's up with the reunion?
Well, we have a lot of fun playing together. And, you know, Steve talked a little while ago about us listening to each other. We listen to each other well. And we also have something that I really enjoy about the blues itself, and you see it in this fellow in particular, is that we get carried away. You know, the blues, in my opinion, is simple for a reason. At its best, it's simple so that it can express emotion and it can be accessible. It's a folk music. It's the people's music. And part of it is to not play it like a metronome or like it's written in charts, but part of it is to have it simple and clear enough that you can improvise and get carried away, get emotional. If you want to speed up, speed up. If you want to get loud, get loud. You want to bring it down, bring it down. These are all different colors you can paint with. When we're playing together and we're firing on all cylinders, which is more often than I've had with most bands, that's why we're reuniting. And also, this particular place that we're going to be playing for, the benefit for the Lemieux Healthcare Clinic, is an important cause, a great cause, and it's something it intersects really well with this idea of us getting together again.
George, you mentioned playing on Maxwell Street with Big Walter Horton, and then obviously you were here in the Twin Cities, during even I would call maybe a blues heyday back in the 90s, early 2000s. What was it like for you on Maxwell Street? What was it like here in the Twin Cities back then?
Playing with Big Walter Horton, I did that on a couple of tours and also a few gigs in Champaign. I didn't play with him on Maxwell Street. I played with Bill Gault on Maxwell Street.
Oh, okay.
And the way that would work for us was we would play Saturday nights at different, you know, bars in Champaign or in Central Illinois. And then with a friend of ours who used to work at Alligator Records, we would go up to Maxwell Street and play all of Sunday with Little Pat Rushing, one of the fellas who had a regular spot there. And it was a pretty amazing scene.
Can you describe what Maxwell Street was like? Because in blues lore, it is legendary now, but then the city of Chicago basically just said, no, you ain't going to do this anymore, and stopped it. But it was a real cultural thing.
It was a carnival. It was a circus. It was a party. And it was hot, hard work all rolled up into one. I remember one time coming in, it was like about 6:15 in the morning, and I was riding in the back of the truck as we were coming in with equipment, and there was a woman with a PA system and a tambourine, and she was saying, come to God, come to the Lord, and all this, and we come in, and things get louder and louder, and there's three or four gospel bands already set up and playing. Then there's the blues guys tuning up across the street. There's the smell of Polish sausage cooking and onions and all sorts of, like, incense and street smells, which, are, by the way, are quite a bit different than incense, and all sorts of things going on. And about 8 or 9 o'clock, the guy they call the bootleg man would come around with selling beers and half pints of whiskey out of a back of his thing. And we would play up till about 6, maybe. And it was very often pretty hot. Out in like our place was a parking lot, but there were places like right all along the street. I mean, within 15, 20 feet of each other at times.
It's George Boyle. I'm John Norton. This is GLT Sound Ideas. Steve the Harp is also in the studio. We're talking about a Blue Aces reunion. The band played in Bloomington Normal and around Central Illinois from the mid to late 1990s through the early 2000s. And Steve, you're reuniting. George just talked about Maxwell Street up in Chicago. Was there an equivalent at all here in Bloomington Normal or even Central Illinois? There is no exact equivalent. It was such a unique thing. But what was the scene in the Twin Cities back in the day?
Well, you know, I'm a hometown boy, so I know it from the get-go, and I was playing trumpet in a rhythm and blues band with Big Ed Moore, who was on bass, and the guy who owns Jazz Up Front. James Gaston, my lead singer, and we were in a band called Soul Seekers and then Band X. And this was in the late 60s, and we were playing mostly fraternity and sorority parties at ISU and Wesleyan.
Well, when things go wrong, what go wrong with you? Lord, it hurts me too.
The Blue Aces is what you're hearing. It Hurts Me Too is the song. And this is GLT Sound Ideas as we get ready for the reunion at the Castle Theater on Sunday night. In studio, Steve the Harp Melberg and George Boyle.
Thanks, John.
There's been a resurgence in the Bloomington Normal music scene, maybe not necessarily the blues scene, but the Bloomington Normal music scene. There's been a resurgence over the past 5 or 6 years, and the Castle is getting a lot of credit for that.
Absolutely.
How does what the Castle's doing compare to what it was like back in the day?
Well, you know, we are excited about playing the Castle. We've been there, and Steve's played there a number of times. I've not played there, but I've gone there and heard music there, and it's done a lot to help the music scene, which is getting better. You know, John, when I was, I don't want to just talk about the past, but when I was growing up in Chicago, there were lots of places to play. I started playing at age like 11 in terms of playing first like family parties, but then, you know, by 12 or 13 playing weddings and retirement parties and all sorts of, but most fun for me as a kid was playing these different dances that all the various high schools and grade schools had. And when I got older, the bar scene was a lot more lively than it, you know, had been for some time. And it's kind of nice to see this resurgence. You know, I have a couple kids that play instruments. And I wonder about where you know, they can get the kind of ability to hone their chops that Steve and I had. You know, the places, like Steve had said, nobody starts off great, you know, or even good, right? We all start off,
beginners.
Just as beginners, that's right. And you have to get some practice to do that.
Yes.
And I just want to apologize to all the people I practiced on so early in my career. I've heard some of those tapes. And but anyway, so it's exciting to see that the Castle and some of these other venues are bringing back live music, because not only is it fun for us to play, but it lets us know that there's going to be a venue for live musicians who are coming up and coming along the way and have great stuff to put out.
In 57, my mom took me to Castle Theater to see Ten Commandments.
Charlton Heston.
Yeah, and in 1937, my mom was going there on Saturday afternoons to watch the Westerns with all the kids in the neighborhood, and she got to go because she was pulling weeds all day on the neighbor's garden so she could get a quarter to go watch the movies in the afternoon in 1937 at the Castle Theater in downtown Bloomington.
So I'm guessing you're not going to turn to your wife, Deb, Steve, and go, Deb, if you pull all the weeds, you can come see the Blue Aces at the Castle.
You got it.
George Boyle. That's Steve Melberg on harp. Steve, the harp, Melberg. And also Billy Gault and Al Chapman, the Blue Aces. Thanks for coming in, guys. It's great to talk to you.
Thanks. Thank you, John.
Appreciate it.
Steve the Harp, Melberg, and George Boyle talking with GLT's John Norton about the Blue Aces reunion concert Sunday night at the Castle Theater. The two will be joined by Billy Gault and Al Chapman. The show is a benefit for Heart of Africa and Marketplace.
Well, the blues is all right when there's someone left to play the game. Is all right when there's someone left to play the game. Now my friends have gone and left me, things just ain't the same.
The blues is all right. It's the Blue Aces on Sound Ideas. Find this interview and more interviews, music interviews, with GLT's music podcast. Subscribe to that and the full Sound Ideas podcast at WGLT.org. Our website is also where you can find today's individual interviews. Tweet about the show. Use the hashtag Sound Ideas. I'm at Mike McCurdy. We're all at WGLT.org. This is WGLT Normal 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.